Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Maya Brown Zimmerman from the Marfan Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the Marfan Foundation.
Okay, the Marfan Foundation is based in New York, and we serve people with Marfan syndrome and a host of related disorders. Our programming is based in the U.S. We have people from all over the world that come to our annual conference, and our materials are available in multiple languages and accessible to anybody.
So for those who might not be as familiar with what Marfan syndrome is, can you give me an overview?
Marfan syndrome is a heritable disorder of the connective tissue, meaning that it's genetic and it affects most of your body. The glue that keeps your body together is connective tissue. So one of the most dangerous parts about Marfan syndrome is that it can cause aortic aneurysms. It can also cause problems with the eyes, lens detachment or lens displacement, retinal detachment, glaucoma. Can cause emphysema, loss of the lung, asthma, problems with the nervous system, issues with the skin like stretch marks. People with Marfan syndrome tend to be taller than the rest of their family. They tend to be thin and hypermobile. And there can be issues with the bones like scoliosis and kyphosis.
So, at present, are there any treatments you're aware of?
Right now, patients with Marfan syndrome use blood pressure medication, either beta blockers or angiotensin receptor blockers like Losartan, to keep their blood pressure very low. And that helps to take the pressure off the aorta and to slow the aortic growth. Losartan and Irbesartan both ARBs can be used to treat the emphysema. And then there's surgery that can be done once the aorta gets to a certain point. They can do preventative surgery to try to prevent an aortic dissection, which is when an aneurysm tears, and that can be fatal. So we have much better surgical techniques now than we used to, but there's no cure.
So for the foundation itself, are there any challenges in providing information and service to people affected?
Well, one challenge would be that it's estimated that only half of people who have Marfan syndrome are aware that they have the diagnosis. So we are constantly trying to get the word out to medical professionals that might be in a position to diagnose Marfan syndrome and related disorders, and also to the general public, so that if they notice those signs in themselves or a loved one, that they know how to go and advocate for a diagnosis.
So, on that subject, what are some of the warning signs?
Really classic signs would be a tall, thin stature, hypermobility. If you have lens displacement, then that usually happens in childhood. That's a big red flag. And you know, you or a loved one has a history of aortic dissection, that's another sign to look for.
So, in your time with the foundation, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Yeah, I can think of several. One would be the clinical trial that we did a few years ago. And that was to compare etanolol, which is a beta blocker, to losartan. And we were able to get together over 600 participants. So it's the largest study of beta blocker versus ARB in the world to date. And to be able to get really good data on which is more effective, and we found that both are equally effective with the correct dosing. And we've been able to get Marfan syndrome mentioned in a lot of popular TV and movies. We've had a really successful Walk for Victory program, which is where we have walks across the country to raise awareness and funds. And, you know, we've been able to have some great spokespeople like Austin Carlisle, who have talked about their diagnosis publicly and been a lot of awareness with the foundation.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for the foundation?
Well, we have our annual conference coming up, and that is going to be the first week of August in Atlanta, Georgia. This is going to be our largest conference to date. We already have 600 families, or over 600 families, that are registered to attend. And then we have a lot of medical professionals that come as well. So that's something I'm really looking forward to. We offer a free clinic with that to help people who don't have access to Marfan syndrome specialists in their areas to be able to get second opinions or to be able to get diagnosed. We're also expanding our regional symposiums, which are kind of like day-long mini-conferences. So we have one coming up in Detroit, and then one in Cleveland, Ohio, coming up in the fall as well.
So, if you could send any one message about the need for greater awareness of Marfan syndrome, what would you say?
Having the awareness saves lives. That when you know what you're looking for, people can get an early diagnosis. And we know that early diagnosis and early treatment makes a huge difference. And, you know, with the long-term health of the individual. And when you're properly diagnosed and you're following the treatment plan, we have a normal average life expectancy. And if you're not diagnosed, that life expectancy is cut pretty dramatically. So awareness really is a first step to a long and healthy life.
So where can my audience go to get more information on the foundation itself?
Go to marfan.org, marfan.org. We also have a Facebook page, which is called the Marfan Foundation.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Bonnie Brayton from the Disabled Women's Network. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with Dawn.
Well, I think since the last time we spoke, Cameron, one of the projects that we have launched and we're partway through is a project called Legislation, Policy, and Service Responses to Violence Against Women with Disabilities and Deaf Women. We may have just been at the beginning of the project the last time we spoke, I'm not sure. So we're at sort of the midpoint in the project, and we've done some research in Quebec, Ontario, and British Columbia to look at legislation and policy in terms of what's offered and been in place for women with disabilities and deaf women. And again, I think, you know, it's timely because Minister Qualtro, of course, is looking at national legislation. So being able to look at Ontario where there's been legislation has been an interesting part of that research. It hasn't, unfortunately, revealed any marked differences in terms of what the research is showing between Ontario and the other provinces, unfortunately, which I think, you know, is an important thing for us to be thinking about now that we're looking at federal legislation and looking broadly at legislation is hopefully one of the ways that we can begin to address the many, many areas where there's gaps in access to services, health care, and employment for people with disabilities, and of course, in our case, for women with disabilities. In addition to that, I was going to say, I think the most important recent development was a trip I took to Washington, D.C. in June. We were honored to be selected by the U.S. State Department for a leadership exchange with some folks from the states around the human trafficking issues. Again, those would be both labor and sex trafficking. And that one was pretty heavy in terms of where it's gone, Cam. I don't want to talk without giving you some space to ask questions about it, but I will say that the subject of human trafficking and people with disabilities is not something that I think we talk nearly enough about to start with. And beyond that, I will say that, you know, I'm happy to talk about certainly some of the things that emerge from this in terms of where our concerns should be.
So for a person with a disability facing something like human trafficking, what are some of the ways that a person can seek help and find a way out of the situation?
Well, I was going to say, I think that's part of the problem, Cam, is that there aren't any obvious routes out at this stage. The two types of trafficking we're talking about, of course, are labor trafficking and sex trafficking. The ways out routes in those two areas can be similar or different. It certainly starts with, you know, and again, this is a challenge for me because we know that one of the things that's a huge problem is people with disabilities' trust of the police and police services, and going to the police for protection sometimes doesn't feel like the right thing to do when they're not always the same people who make you feel safe. And in line with what we know about trafficking, and in particular sex trafficking, you know, often instead of being seen as a victim, people who are trafficked are seen as criminals themselves and become criminalized by the type of activity that they're being forced into. So here in Canada, we really, I'm sorry to say, have absolutely no strategy in place with respect to people with disabilities and trafficking. It's not really even acknowledged as an issue from a policy perspective at this point by the government in any way that I've seen. They do acknowledge trafficking and they have resources directed towards human trafficking, but, you know, haven't added the disability lens in any meaningful way. You know, and I think when we're talking about trafficking, you know, we're not talking about, you know, in the context of some types of trafficking, what most people would perceive as our community. So, again, you know, these are often people with invisible disabilities, brain injuries, mild intellectual disabilities, or mental health issues, you know, in terms of who would be, you know, more typically the victim of sex trafficking. But I have, again, talked to different colleagues from across Canada and, you know, from our international network, and one of the things we know that's a really deep concern is the trafficking, for example, of people with disabilities from other countries into Canada. We know of, for example, instances of children with disabilities from Mexico being brought to Canada to beg. And then, of course, the money that that is collected is not for the children, and the children are not provided with even the basics of sustenance in terms of food and shelter, far less being acknowledged or paid or remunerated in any way for what they're doing. They're forced into it. I think one of the most appalling instances that I came across through this research and this opportunity to do this knowledge exchange with colleagues from the States was instances of children actually having been dismembered, in other words, so that they could be put out there to beg on the basis that they had no limb.
So is one possible factor of why these children are trafficked that in their home country, as children with disabilities, their status is not the same as their average citizen?
I think that's absolutely true, Cam. I think that one of the things we know, for example, with another very disturbing case I learned about was deaf girls from Eastern European countries who, again, rather than being provided with an education or the opportunity to learn sign language, they are deliberately kept from learning any way to communicate or speak and are trafficked from when they're children. And you know, again, this is around, like you said, the invisibility of children with disabilities in some countries where, again, they're not given a birth certificate. They're not even acknowledged as existing in many cases. You know, some of these are due to you know, cultural pressures, and in some instances, it's simply the lack of resources to the, you know, the poorest people in communities for the possibility of being able to imagine supporting their children. In some cases, parents are tricked into believing that if they give custody of their children over to these people, that their children will have a better life somewhere else. So it's, you know, it's a complex social problem that has a lot of different policy implications. And I think really where it starts, Cam, is with beginning to understand that when we're talking about any kind of exploitation, that we're talking about any kind of situation where people are facing violence or discrimination, that you can assume and you must assume that some of those folks are going to be people with disabilities, and that this is a fundamental failure that we're seeing across, you know, our country and just sort of more broadly around why we continue to see so many systemic problems for people with disabilities, both here in Canada and abroad, which is this failure to, and again, it brings me back to the project we're just talking about at the beginning of the call, which is a failure to add the disability lens to policy, a failure to add the disability lens to programming, and a failure to add disability to an understanding of addressing any social issue.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thanks, Cam.
Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages.
The Windsor Youth Center is the only drop-in community center for homeless and at-risk youth in Windsor, Essex. WIC provides helpful and experienced staff members and offers several important services such as meals, snacks, opportunities to explore creative expression, resume help, and a safe space for youth to come together. The Windsor Youth Center is open Monday to Saturday from 5 to 10 p.m. and is located at 1247 Wyandotte Street East. Get help or lend a hand right here in your community at the Windsor Youth Center.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Maya Brown Zimmerman and Bonnie Brighton. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Leslie Kimball from Alpha One Canada. So tell me a little bit about Alpha One Canada.
Alpha One Canada is a patient support group, which works to support people diagnosed with Alpha One antitrypsin deficiency and their family members as well. We came to be back in the early 2000s. And our mandate basically is to identify alphas throughout Canada and to work with them to access treatment and to try and get them drug coverage.
So for those who might not be as familiar, how does this deficiency affect a person?
Okay. So alpha-1 antitrypsin is manufactured in the liver, and it goes out through the wall of the liver into the bloodstream and up to the lung to protect the lungs. The protein can't get out of the liver, and people who have alpha-1, they do make the protein, but they can't get it into the bloodstream through the wall of the liver. So what happens is it results in damage to the lung over, you know, a period of 2 or 3 decades. So the lung disease is sort of the most common of the alpha-1 antitrypsin disease. There's also a secondary form of the disease, which is liver. And because the alpha-1 is collecting in the liver, some people do develop a cirrhosis type liver disease. And there is a third, even more rare form of the disease, which manifests itself as paniculitis, which is a skin disease. So it's sort of three components of the disease. The bulk of our patients are lung affected.
So are there any treatments available at present?
Yes, there is. There is one treatment that is available for the lung disease. It is an augmentation therapy, which is basically an infusion of the alpha-1 antitrypsin protein. Most patients receive it on a weekly basis, and it sort of delivers the alpha-1 through the bloodstream to the lung without having to, so it bypasses the liver. So it is not a cure by any stretch of the imagination, but it does tend to slow down the progression of the disease. As far as the liver goes, basically liver transplant is the only cure for that. And for the skin disease, the prolactin augmentation therapy has been known to work, but it doesn't have to be a continued therapy. It can be several treatments of the therapy to affect the skin disease.
So, in your time with Alpha One Canada, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Ooh. Well, certainly we have a challenge in that the disease itself is considered a rare disease. And it may not be as much rare as it is underdiagnosed. So we believe that there are as many as 5,000 to 7,000 Canadians who are affected by alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. But we actually only have 300 what we call ZZ alphas in our registry. So one of the big challenges is identifying the patients across the country. And to do that, we need to work very closely with, you know, family doctors and specialists and respiratory therapists to get the word out about alpha-1. One of the reasons that it's underdiagnosed is because it resembles very closely other COPDs, bronchitis, asthma, emphysema, and essentially the lung disease is emphysema, but it is an inherited emphysema. So we need to promote testing of patients who have a history of COPD, particularly if they are non-smokers and very young and developing lung disease. We need to promote testing for people who have a history of, a familial history of liver disease, for instance. So that is a huge challenge for us is identifying Canadians. And both those who have been diagnosed and those who have yet to be diagnosed. That's probably our biggest challenge that we face. The other one is that the drug is not covered by most governments. It is covered in BC and Alberta. However, it's not covered in other provinces. And so we do have people identified with the disease and who have been prescribed the augmentation therapy, but it is extremely expensive. It's about $2,000 a week. And so it's primarily the patients who have private coverage who get the drug.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
For more information, look up Alpha One Canada online. To my mind, folks, A lot of great stories were shared today, but I find it frankly disturbing from Bonnie Brayton's interview about the whole issue surrounding human trafficking. How is it that simply because these children with disabilities have lesser status in their own culture, that they are sent out to beg, that they are just disregarded as people? The human trafficking issue, it's ongoing, and it is an uphill battle. But the fact of the matter is, we have to do better by all people. We have to look with just general regard for their humanity. The recognition that a child with a disability, regardless of where they're coming from, has the potential to learn, grow, love, and even lead for the future. The fact of the matter is, we have a very simple choice. Do we not look upon these issues because we're uncomfortable with them, or because we're afraid? Or do we come together, establish a policy, establish a systematic plan to make sure it's not happening? Disability has struck in every family to one degree or another. But the fact is, if you look at such a child in a trafficking situation, you must ask yourself, how would I feel this was my child? How would I feel knowing this young person, this beautiful, innocent life, is being so exploited, and I just looked away? Yes, we can certainly choose to do that. However, fact is, no person of conscience can let this go on and not at least take objection to it. Fact is, Dawn does some amazing work, and they have some great people leading them. But having the chance to share information and resources about one of the most pressing and frankly disturbing issues in our culture today, that was a great thing. It was a great opportunity for Bonnie to learn and share some insights. But I long for that day, folks. The day when we don't have to worry, is this child with a disability going to have the chance to grow up in safety? Or worse still, from a cultural standpoint, having to ask the question, will this child have a chance to grow up at all? Because every life, my friends, is potentialed and sacred. The fact is, it is a difficult thing that we're asking the world to overcome. The ignorance of labor and other forms of exploitation. We're asking people to find a better way. We are asking the world stage to recognize these children with disabilities just that, people. People with the potential to lead for a future. People with the potential to create and to hope and to dream. What message does it send to a generation of leaders when we create the impossible standard? By which I mean, yeah, we'll accept you because you're this, this, and this. No, we'll just kind of shun you aside simply because you move or learn or think a little bit differently. We're actually going to turn a blind eye towards your victimization. That's not all right, folks. And we as a people can and must do better. The first step, I suppose, is getting the word out there. Just being open and honest. If you suspect something like that is going on, talk about it. Bring it to light. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.